Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, February 18th, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Ben Burgess, columnist at Jacobin, host of Give Them an Argument, author of his latest book, Christopher Hitchens, What He Got Right, How He Went Wrong, and Why It Still Matters. Also on the program today, comedian Jenna Friedman will be joining us. She's the host of the comedic true crime series, Indefensible. Also on the program today, shelling intensifies between Ukraine and Russian-backed separatist forces. Meanwhile, the U.S. Senate approves a Ukraine resolution warning Russia. New York State Supreme Court justice rules that the New York Attorney General can compel Trump and kids to answer questions under oath. Meanwhile, new report. Michelle Childs, James Clyburn, and Lindsey Graham's pick for the Supreme Court once sentenced a man to 12 years in prison for selling a cup of weed. 8 ounces. I mean, it's not exactly a cup. Meanwhile, Biden administration says agencies are running out of COVID dollars. And child poverty spiked 41% with the expiration of the child tax credit. Right-wing faceplant as Durham of the Durham investigation concedes that the internet data he cited in his filing came during the Obama, not Trump, White House administration. Global COVID cases dropping as a new subvariant is monitored, and 19 Austin, Texas police officers indicted over their 2020 BLM protest response. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it. Joining me as always on this casual Friday, where I am, how would I say, I'm but be collared, be soft collared. Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma.
Hello to you and your collar.
You were waiting to see where I was going with that.
I still don't fully understand where you went with that, but that's all right.
I was trying to say, like, I am bedazzled or bespectacled, I don't know, bespectacled in a soft collar. No.
Yeah. I mean, you're certainly bespectacled, I guess, right? You got the glasses, and soon, hopefully, you're bedazzled when you just make sure that you can put some beading on that shirt, make it look fancy.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. I did, I know you looked at me funny when I said, 8 ounces. I said a cup of weed.
Right.
And I said, it's not really, because it was 8 ounces. And yes, all cats are beautiful on the IM. Said Sam, weed ounces are done by weight, not volume, like ounces in a cup. I know that. But I wanted to sort of just to say 8 ounces of weed. People don't, you know, I wanted to just say a cup of weed. That's,
yeah,
I
you wanted to say
there's
a couple
a
weeks.
Difference between weight and volume. I get it. I get it.
You found it humorous, and it also made you look like a total loser. That's all right.
I wouldn't say total loser. I would say maybe somebody who doesn't know science.
No, or just such a square that you don't know how weed is sold.
In my day, it was in baggies. Baggies, not little bags. But you roll. Okay.
Yeah.
Like,
well,
quart bag. Nickel. You get a dime bag.
There is a nickel. There are real dispensaries just like popping up everywhere. I mean, yeah. When I have kids, or if I do have kids, they're going to be like, wow, that used to be illegal. And that blows my mind. But that's a whole separate conversation. But if Childs does get confirmed and is the pick, we'll have a Supreme Court justice who was instrumental in criminalizing that, or at least in terms of her rulings.
That's pretty excessive. I don't know the idea that there wasn't any room to do anything other than 12 years just seems absurd to me. But also, would you just mention Donald Trump is in some trouble here with this U.S. attorney. I mean, I should say this New York State attorney investigation that Letitia James can question Trump and at least two of his children. It is a civil inquiry. I just want to remind people about his business practices. But it's not impossible for these investigations to move from a civil inquiry into a criminal inquiry. And you know, bank fraud, particularly with how much we venerate our banks in this country, can be serious. I was hoping to have one of these days. We've got to find out an expert on this. But the real question is, could Donald Trump have a Secret Service protection in prison? I wonder if he would have a Secret Service. That would be interesting.
I mean, he would. If he actually went to prison, I would love to see how his look evolves. I mean, he wouldn't be able to get that tanning thing that he likes to do, the spray tan, the hair dye would be very different.
Tan. You don't think so?
You think he could get a spray tan in prison? It would probably be a fancy one.
It'd be interesting. All right. Well, let's start with this. This clip, I feel, has it all, ladies and gentlemen. And I think it's a good argument that to the extent that people refer to the United States as an experiment, we could be wrapping this thing up. Here is Senator Tommy Tuberville, who I'm convinced is perhaps one of the stupidest senators, not just that we have in the Senate today, but through time. And he is speaking with Maria Bartiromo, Fox. She Fox News or Fox Business News? Doesn't matter.
I think she's both, right? But her show's got to be on business because they kind of, that's where they would quarantine the crazies, the craziest, I feel like. But
all right, well, let's play this clip. Here's Tommy Tuberville. Now, remember, we're very close to, I mean, with the shelling that has been going on, or at least reportedly going on, we're getting closer to the potential or another war or another invasion by Russia of Ukraine. I don't think that we should get involved in any way militarily, but nevertheless, this is a pretty serious thing for the United States. Certainly, there's some in the blob, as it were, that is all gung ho for some form of war. But this is the way that Tuberville has asked this question. Pretty impressive.
Coach, what about that? And what about this hysteria that the State Department went through all weekend? Because on Friday, you've got Jake Sullivan telling us that Russia would invade Ukraine today. I mean, to be so specific, and all the leakers leaking that it was today, Wednesday, to be so specific, and then Joe Biden telling us, get out of Ukraine immediately. Was this a ruse? was this whole thing an effort to take everybody's attention away from what Hillary Clinton did and what we know to be a complete hoax over this Russia investigation? What are your thoughts? Because I know Jake Sullivan worked for Hillary Clinton, and he was one of the people who was peddling this Russia collusion lie for 4 years. And there he is now as NSA coming up with this hysteria over Russia.
They're scrambling. There's no doubt about it. I wouldn't trust Jake Sullivan or Mayorkas or Secretary Blinken as far as I could throw them. I've heard them talk. They give us information. They speak in circles. They don't talk directly to you. They talk around you. They have their own agenda. And the American people will eventually find this out. It's catching up with them. This Durham report is unbelievable, spying on an American president. But that being said, they've got a problem in Ukraine that they need to work out, but they need to work it out with the people that are within the problem, the president of Ukraine and Putin. We need to be the intermediary in between them. Get them together.
Get
all these people killed. Our number one adversary is China. And all they want to do is take our eyes off the ball. And China's in on this. You know they're behind it. They're pushing Putin. They're just seeing how far we'll go. This is just the start of something that we're going to see for the next few years with President Biden and his administration that can't make decisions the right way.
That was indecipherable. They talk in front of you. They talk behind you. They talk upside down, below, in and out, left, right, every which way they're talking around you.
They're doing end
rounds.
What
does Mayorkas have to do with Ukraine and Russia? Have I missed the Department of Homeland Security getting involved? And I don't trust Blinken or Mayorkas or the Department of Education on this whole Ukraine thing. Mm. I don't.
The Department of the Interior, because this is coming from the interior of the White House. Yeah.
Health and Human Services has been all over the place on the Ukraine situation. Is it going to hurt people or be healthy for them?
Obviously, it can't be healthy.
Yeah, why didn't you throw Fauci in there?
Oh, yeah.
Fauci?
Right. He missed opportunity.
I did appreciate, though, that he seemed to have gotten the memo that the spying on the White House wasn't Trump. He wasn't being, you know, and of course there was no spying. There was someone doing analysis of a White House server for security purposes, but it was during the Obama administration. So the idea, the theory is that Bartiromo is saying is that the reason why the administration was getting out in front of their skis or hyping. To the extent that they were hyping the idea of an invasion was to throw people off the scent of the Durham investigation, which said that a lawyer whose firm at one time worked for the Clinton administration, who supposedly lied about not working for the Clinton campaign, but wasn't working at that time for the Clinton campaign, knew a guy who was part of the team to investigate the White House server when Obama was there. And the Biden administration just doesn't want this information to get out there, even though it has literally been on Fox News 24/7.
It's a perfect crime.
So the theory is that Jake Sullivan is drumming up this conflict between Russia and Ukraine to distract from a piece of information in this memo that was available in another finding 4 years ago or something like that. I mean, that is three-dimensional chess.
Well, I would say it's closer to nine-dimensional chess because they're doing this to protect Hillary Clinton, who really is not part of the administration.
But she is, though, right? She's always a part of every Democratic. Hillary.
That is
always everywhere.
But Tuberville got it. He came off as a statesman. there. Oh, we really got to become an intermediary. Look, the people, we've got to deal with Ukraine and Russia with Ukraine and Russia. I don't know, like, who else was he talking? Well, who else is the Biden administration involving? I mean, I guess NATO. Is he saying that we shouldn't involve Europeans in this conversation either?
Perhaps he's saying that not enough people are involved.
Intermediary.
I honestly do think that clip is basically it. That's Exhibit A, that we're wrapping this thing up, folks.
That's the end.
Yep.
Enjoy
Good
it.
Run. Good run. Buttigieg, I don't trust him on this Ukraine thing at all.
Thank you, Coach. Thank
we're
you, Coach.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with Ben Burgess. But just a reminder, folks, this program sponsored by my favorite sponsor, SunsetLakeSabade.com. Left is best. Gets you 20% off. It gets you 20% off the tinctures, which now come in a bigger size. You get a bigger dosage of the Sebade. Also flavored mint and citrus. It gets you 20% off the smokables. They have pre-rolls. They have keef that Matt likes to grind with his other stuff. Matt, what do you do? Do you put that in a pipe or do you put that in some type of other taller device or do you put it in papers?
Yeah, put in a giant bong.
Giant bong. How big is your bong?
About a foot tall.
Wow.
Is it really? That's not giant.
Well, okay, it's large.
You wait. After the show today, I'll talk to you about giant bongs.
It's about as wide as a Coke can, too.
Oh, really?
Jeez, really? Come on, man. You're out of college. You can do more better than the cocaine. Anyways, Left is Best also has salves with Arnica. It has hemp lotion for your dry skin. There's Sebade fudge, Sebade coffee, great different roasts that take the edge off the caffeine. There is gummies, and all of their products have an incredible amount of integrity. You can check third-party analysis of everything that is in that Sebade, whatever it is that you're, or whatever form it comes in. You can find that on their website. Great business practices, $15 minimum wage for their workers, mostly an employee-owned company. They have been incredibly generous in supporting striking nurses in Worcester, in supporting food banks around the area up in Burlington, Vermont, where they work out of. And as well as, you know, we ran a big promo for Give Directly last year. Just a great all-around company, great all-around product. My sleeping has been enhanced dramatically. I don't know if people pick up on that, but that's why I don't stutter as much, I think. Do I?
Maybe not.
No comment.
I mean, I don't know this difference, but I take your word for it.
All right. Well, whatever. SunsetLakeSabade.com. Left is best for 20% off. Check it out. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Ben Burgess will be here. Columnist at Jacobin, host of Give Them an Argument, author Christopher Hitchens. What he got right, how he went wrong, and why he still matters. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Joining us, Ben Burgess, columnist at Jacobin, host of Give Them an Argument, of which I've appeared on a couple of times, and also author of his latest, Christopher Hitchens, What He Got Right, How He Went Wrong, and Why He Still Matters. Ben, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me back on, Sam.
I want to just briefly talk a little bit about your book. I haven't read it yet. Let me guess about what how he went wrong.
Yeah.
Did some of that involve a bottle?
I don't know how much it did, because I think that there are probably a lot of people who overindulged in whiskey as much as he did, who maintained, you know, good anti-war positions, you know, to the end of their lives. I don't know if they need to start putting, like, warning, may start supporting U.S. imperialism on the back of Johnny Walker Black. I do think obviously something went disastrously wrong with the positions that he was taking on Iraq and the war on terror. And I think it is interesting to try to think about what that was, right? Because I think sometimes on the left, we make the mistake of being a little bit too quick to say that it's everybody sort of, everybody kind of secretly agrees with us, right? And so, like, if you say you don't, like, you're a grifter or something like that, especially if you start out agreeing. And I do think it's sincere. I just think it's, like, tragically misguided, you know, that he had talked himself into this position that the United States could be a vehicle for democratic revolution in Middle Eastern nations, which I think is wrong, both in terms of, like, U.S. goals. I think the U.S. like likes democracy in these countries to the exact extent that it's favorable to U.S. interests and not beyond that. I think if you look at, like, you know, Egypt, et cetera, right? I think there's plenty of evidence for that. But I think it's also wrong just in terms of capacity. I mean, I think, like, what I, you know, thinking about, like, the 20 years that we spent in Afghanistan, it seems like, putting morality aside, you know, whether it would have been right to do if it had been possible or not, I think what overwhelmingly emerges to me is that the U.S. just doesn't have the capacity to remake these societies in our own image.
Yeah, I think that last point is often sort of, we never get to that point in a lot of times in the conversation. I mean, I remember back in 2011 when we were, when the big conversation was, what should our involvement in Syria be? And it seemed to me like, I happen to be one of those people who find it very hard to believe that Assad won his vote, his election, 95% to 5%. I'm suspicious of that for some reason.
You think it was probably more like 6 or 7% who,
Like,
it's maybe, something around maybe the edges. Yeah.
But, and I think, you know, my understanding of the Assad regime is it's a horror show.
Yeah.
But that, and particularly in 2010, 2011, when there was, seemed to be at least some genuine democratic impetus within that civil war, some element of the, you know, that civil war involved sort of like genuine, I think, you know, people who had values that we could really appreciate. The question was like, how can we not screw this up? Like, I mean, how would our involvement, like, where has our involvement proved beneficial for anything? Even if we were to have the best of intentions, which I don't ever believe that we really do for the most part, you know, there's always a mix of things, but where is the example? You know, I suppose Grenada, maybe we liberated, but I'm being facetious there. But where have we been involved, particularly in that region, where we haven't left a greater disaster than existed beforehand? And not just a greater disaster for the way that we're perceived in the world, but obviously a greater disaster for the people who are there. But
yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a line in Adolf Reed had this article late last year called "The Whole Country Is the Reichstag," where he remembers drinking at a bar in Washington D.C. with Christopher Hitchens, you know, during the beginning of the war in Afghanistan, and Reed telling him that, you know, the presence of the 82nd Airborne has never made anywhere better, even their, you know, like, Fayetteville, you know, which I think is absolutely, right. I mean, I think that the, you know, with the possible exception, as he goes on to admit, of the, you know, enforcement of integration, you know, within the United States by it. But like, other than that, right, that they have, you know, it's really hard to come up with a plausible example. And you can construct a fantasy scenario in your head where everything worked out great. And the result of the intervention was to create a stable democratic state, with, you know, where people enjoyed all the freedoms that we'd want them to. And there wasn't, you know, mass death and suffering and all that stuff. And you can sort of say, well, why would you be against that? And it's like, well, I don't know why that's the question. Right. I mean, I don't really feel the need to either be for or against things that aren't actually ever going to happen.
Right. I can't assess what my life would be like if I had wings and was able to fly. I mean, maybe it would be a good thing. Maybe it would turn out to be not a great thing. I mean, who's making T-shirts with wing holes in it? But if I remember correctly,
I've got to say that seems like that would probably not be the main issue with that scenario.
But I mean, it would be pretty uncomfortable. I don't think that any of us wearing anything that it would be comfortable to have wings on the back.
It's soft collar day, Ben.
Right. Yeah. But if I remember correctly with Hitchens, it was about the Kurds for him.
Yeah. Wasn't that it?
He was hoping for a Kurdish state in northern Iraq, if I remember correctly. And there were other people. I feel like Peter Galbraith was also very much inclined. And Joe Biden actually had floated at the time, too, a three-way partition of Iraq that included a Kurdish state in the north. And
the arrogance of like being able to actually with a straight face say that we'll just divvy it up based on my assessment of the situation here.
I mean, when Joe Biden entered into the Senate, he was probably only about 40 years out from when that all happened anyways with the British in that same area. I mean, so, you know,
but I'll do it better, but I'll do it better. Right.
I mean, that was the thought process of the day. Was it, I mean,
I think it was definitely an important moment in it because he had opposed the first Gulf War. And after that, though, he did spend time in northern Iraq in that like de facto autonomous Kurdish region that was protected by the no-fly zone. And as my friend Gian Bajalan points out, like Kurdish leaders in northern Iraq, who for, you know, obvious reasons were all in favor of the idea of the United States taking care of Saddam Hussein for them, some of those people had been 1970s radicals themselves. They could speak to Hitchens in his own language. You know, he was sort of very impressed by kind of seeing like socialist imagery and, you know, Kurdish, you know, that, that Kurdish region. And so I think this is part of it. Also, though, I will say, I think this is part of a broader shift in his worldview that happens over the course of the 90s and then kind of comes to a head with 9/11, because I think part of what's changing his thinking about this is that if you go back and read what he was writing for The Nation in the 80s and early 90s, when he's railing against American foreign policy, I think one of the things that most sort of horrifies him about the, like, you know, Reagan's foreign policy, for example, is the U.S. supporting these like death squad dictatorships in Latin America and elsewhere around the world. And, you know, he writes extensively about the crimes of Henry Kissinger, et cetera. But then I think his perception is that in a post-Cold War world where the rules were different, alignments were changing, that the United States was sort of battling very different kinds of enemies. I mean, I think if like George W. Bush had been fighting wars against like peasant communist revolutionaries like LBJ was in Vietnam or, you know, Reagan in Nicaragua, then I don't think Hitchens would have ever been able to bring himself to support that. But I think that when he saw like, you know, the first war, this is, by the way, is one of the reasons I don't think that you can explain it all just by Islamophobia. the first war where Hitchens starts to warm up to the idea that the U.S. military could be a force for good in the world is not one where the U.S. is bombing Muslims. It's Bosnia, where the U.S. is intervening on behalf of Bosnian Muslims against Serbian Christians. And so I think he looks at these forces. He says, okay, well, hold on. Slobodan Milosevic, Saddam Hussein, the Taliban later, right? Are these the kinds of forces that the United States would have been fighting wars against in previous decades? Or are these exactly the kinds of actors that the United States was propping up around the world in previous decades?
With Saddam Hussein, you didn't have to ask. Right. He literally was an example of someone we would prop up. I mean, we were the ones who gave him those chemicals that he used on the Kurds up in the north. Don Rumsfeld, I think, was a chemicals, I can't remember the company, executive at the time, that some of those were delivered, I believe. But
yeah, absolutely. And I also think that part of it has to do with the fact that, you know, he started out life politically as a very radical socialist, but I think over the course of the 1990s, I think he found it harder to sort of maintain confidence that that was a real historical possibility, because in that sort of end of history era, like that just didn't feel plausible to most people who are in any kind of mainstream space. And he even admits in his memoir, Hitch 22, that there's a certain point where, like, towards the end of the 90s, when he probably, like, the only, you know, he thinks in retrospect, the only thing that was still getting him calling himself a socialist is that he, every time he would go on C-SPAN, Brian Lamb would ask him in a really condescending way, are you still socialist? And, like, he didn't want him to win, by saying no. But I mean, I think the way that it ties in is that presumably, I mean, I think like as like a young Trotskyist in the 70s, presumably when he went to places like Iraq, for example, he thought that people living under those despotism would like eventually be swept away by, you know, like wave of, you know, revolutions. And I think that as he sort of starts to lose faith in that, you know, he still wants there to be at least democratic, if not socialist revolutions in those societies, which is the point in this kind of chain of reasoning where I can like maintain sympathy for his position, where I get off board is what we were talking about earlier, thinking that it's realistic on any number of levels to think that the United States could be a vehicle for bringing about democratic revolution in these societies.
It was really strange at the time. I just remember, you know, going and seeing the trials of Henry Kissinger. I can't remember what theater it was downtown. And then, you know, 7 years later, or whatever it was, 5 years later, 6 years later, him being such a proponent for that war, it was rather shocking. But I had sort of missed the interim period of time, I guess, where that was sort of evolving. But let's talk about let's update this with what we're witnessing now. Over the past, I guess, 24, 36 hours, we have had, and again, you know, it's impossible to even state facts or vague facts, like prefacing it and qualifying it is like, these are reports that we have gotten from the news, broadly speaking, various news outlets. But I don't know if there are, you know, if there's anybody who has a corner on the truth that is coming out of this region, but there appears to be, increased shelling, and I'm not even clear, like, you know, who started the shelling or who's fully engaging in the shelling between Ukraine forces and separatist forces, presumably in the I can't pronounce these two regions, Luhansk and Eastern Ukraine and Donbas, and the shelling has been going on, and there was like there's a video now from someone's helmet cam, which ostensibly is some elite squad of supposedly showing Ukrainian sort of elite special ops type of squad that was attempting to blow up some type of chlorine factory in the separatist region. They were thwarted, and which sort of conforms with maybe what the administration had been hinting at in terms of a possible, false flag video showing Ukrainian forces trying to commit some type of mass murder of separatists.
It is super weird to hear that phrase false flag being used by U.S. government officials, because it's one that I normally associate with Alex Jones.
Well, I mean, look, it takes one to know one. I mean, it's not like we haven't been involved in false flag operations.
Right.
Gulf of Tonkin. I mean, the right. U.S. Maine, maybe, there's we've had plenty of these. So the bottom line, though, is it seems like, what does the Biden administration do? Presumably they don't want a war. Although there's a lot of people out there that feels like they do. But I don't know. What's your sense, the Biden administration? I can't see how they think this is good under their watch, as it were.
Yeah, it's really disturbing because it seems like, okay, so things are, heating up again now, between these Russian-backed separatist factions and, the Ukrainian government, I guess it's also worth saying, one thing that complicates all of this is that without making excuses for Russia's regional mini imperialism, it is also the case that the Ukrainian government that exists now, even though they did have a real election since then and all this, is a successor to a depending on your point of view, revolution or coup that overthrew a Russian aligned and very corrupt, but also democratically elected government. And that includes lots of fighting that's been done against the separatists by very strange, far right kind of groups in the Ukraine. Right. So all of which is just to say that there isn't a, I think that kind of the image of this as a besieged, nice democratic country, I think might be a little bit misleading, But I think that it's been really disturbing because even before this heated up, there was this really strange spectacle for a while where, the president of the Ukraine, all right, Ukraine, I know you're supposed to leave off the definite article. I will
I've
do
struggled
that.
With that as well, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, usually my joke is just that they should have been nicer to my family if they wanted me to leave off the definite article, But as the descendant of people who had to get out of the Ukraine in a hurry, but I think that there was this weird thing where Ukrainian officials were saying, "No, calm down, right? There's not going to be an invasion," and it seemed like the Biden administration was saying, "No, there definitely is going to be." And it seemed very unclear what the end game would be. And it seems just an incredibly dangerous thing to saber rattle about, because even though it's probably extremely unlikely that there would be a war that the United States would be directly involved in. I mean, if you think about how many times the United States and at that time the Soviet Union came to obliterating the world in the 20th century. I mean, that seems like something you really don't want to mess around with.
Russians are doing nuclear exercises today, is my understanding, what I would imagine to sort of as a way of maybe increasing the stakes. But I mean, was your sense that the Biden administration was saber rattling? I mean, they were clearly getting out ahead of mm-hmm. where the Ukraine government was. The Ukraine government, I also, my understanding is, was losing billions of dollars, mm-hmm. not the government, but the economy had been losing billions of dollars over the past couple of months because of fears of a Russian invasion. And so they're in this sort of bind where, on one hand, I imagine they want some attention in the event that they at one point thought that maybe Russia was going to invade. we still don't know. Maybe Russia is still going to invade. We just don't know. The United States is not as concerned about the Ukrainian economy, I would imagine, as they are as to their desire for there not to be an invasion, right? I mean, that's my sense. Like, I can't quite figure out why would the Biden administration could certainly be far too arrogant and thinking like Ukrainians don't understand. We have more intelligence or this and that, whatever it is. Look down and be condescending about it. And you're not going to take the lead. We're going to take the lead type of situation, even though we're not really actually going to fight if there is an invasion. But we feel like stopping it, it's worth the billions of dollars that your economy loses because we want to raise the stakes in terms of Russia doing this. And we need for our own domestic, I guess, ability to, you know, have the Senate vote on sanctions or whatever it is. I mean, I guess
one question I always have about this is like, what's the, because we think about the United States, like having, like just sort of naturally having this role in the world. But like, I don't think we would normally ask what, like the, what should Russia have done to stop, pick your favorite U.S., unjustified intervention in the world, right? Like should Gorbachev have done something to stop the invasion of Panama, for example? And that's not clear to me. I mean, like, given that escalated superpower tensions is really bad, given that even though it's extremely unlikely there would be a direct war, it is a potentially catastrophic thing to mess with. It seems like it could be possible both to say that, that like Russia's actions are wildly unjustified and also that having the United States play this kind of role in like sort of facing off over it and escalated tensions is still not what should be happening.
Right. I mean, that's the problem, isn't it? It's like, we'll never know. I mean, if it's unclear if the United States is, even if their intention is, the administration's intention is to avoid a war, it's unclear whether A, they have the ability to do it, B, whether their intervention makes it more likely, C, we'll never know one way or another, regardless of what happens. I mean, because...
And right. It feels like to me that I don't think they want war either, but they're not going to tone down the rhetoric or the, not even saber rattling, but I've been saying this throughout the conflict, the chest puffing in order to ensure that war won't happen. Because I believe there's a perception in the administration that they took a hit on Afghanistan. And that's why we saw this, press conference from Biden that no one asked for about, oh, we assassinated the ISIS leader that you were so terrified about. I mean, no one knew his name and the new one will emerge in a second, but we got them and 13 other civilians as well. And now it's like, let's look really tough on Russia here. Even though my belief is that the average voter who has very little understanding of or care about what's happening in Ukraine right now.
Yeah, and I also wonder, like, I understand that the optics of the way that the pullout from Afghanistan happened, were really bad, but still... I think if it were, up to a popular referendum, the United States would have gone left Afghanistan long before it did. I mean, I think the polling is really clear on that. Right. So I wonder if even as a cynical political calculation, it's actually, I mean, I guess this is what you're saying, Emma, but how much sense it even makes in those terms. Right. Like, is it really the case? That the that anywhere near the top of the list of reasons for Democrats to worry about the midterms or whatever is this perception of being not tough enough in terms of projection of American military power abroad.
Oh, I think, I mean, the I do think that Biden feels like, you know, I came off as a little bit cucked because we got humiliated, as opposed to the actual exit, because the American public, and certainly not the right, doesn't care one whit about Afghanistan. If we did, he would not have split, you know, stolen essentially the Afghan $7 billion,
right,
and taken half of it and then decided how we were going to deploy the other half in terms of humanitarian, supposedly, spending in Afghanistan. Nobody in this country cares about the Afghan people. I'm not, you know, obviously not nobody, yeah, but, right, but the body politic does not care about Afghan people. Yeah. It's really just more about, like, you know, the same sort of rhetoric about Obama apologized in Egypt. You know, he apologized like we look weak, and it is literally that sort of substantive, which is to say, not at all. It is completely and one of the things, and it's maybe there's a good opportunity to pivot to what's going on with the Democrats right now.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that has always sort of, like, you know, there's this sense that if Biden's numbers are bad, it doesn't matter how they get up or what it is that's right. They're going to try everything to get those numbers up, because presumably that's going to help the, you know, the Democrats in the midterm elections. You know, this is on their, you know, their, this is their logic. There may be something to that, but I'm not convinced that this is the way to do it, that the elections are going to turn on, like, Biden's a cuck. We're going to, you know, get cucked in Afghanistan. We're going to.
That's three cucks in the first hour. Now,
yeah,
four.
Sorry about that. There's a poll out now that shows that Democrats, and it's coming out of, not sure what the outfit is here. It is, this is from, I guess, the San Francisco, there's an internal polling, I guess, that shows swing voters believe that the Democrats went too far on COVID, and now they're freaking out. They're also, you know, blaming, of course, the squad, and, you know, defund the police, and, you know, abolish ICE. You know, this is all, they're going to Axios and telling, this is a big, sort of like internal battle within the Democrats. And this is coming out also at a time where there was a very big piece, I think it was in the New Republic, about how Democrats are, consultants, mm-hmm, are running the apparatus to raise low dollar amounts. And a lot of it focused around Sarah Gideon in Maine, who lost in an epic fashion to Susan Collins, arguably the most vulnerable Republican, or should have been the most vulnerable Republican in the country. She lost. And not only did she lose, she lost with $14 million in the bank. This is not a near miss. This isn't like, oh, you missed the runway by 2 feet type of situation. They either decided not to expend all these dollars, or they knew that they were going to lose and they decided to not expend them because they knew they were going to lose. And that she wants to start a foundation now with that money or something to that effect. But there's a whole apparatus that is raising cash. So part of that two-step is to also sort of blame, taking any issues, taking any position on any issues. And the other part of this is sort of just like the absence of not only the Democrats being able to achieve anything legislatively beyond the COVID relief bill, but also Joe Biden, you know, he can act tough, but he also has the ability to do a lot of things through executive action. So somebody, like, you know, touting the fact that the administration waived student debt for 14,000 people who were involved in another sort of corrupt for-profit college university thing. But that authority exists.
Yeah, why not do that for everybody?
Exactly. And
there is, it's, I don't know. There's an eternal question as to whether it's just simply corruption on behalf of the Democrats or also corruption within the Democrats that end up pushing them in a certain direction, or if it's also just like a failure of politics.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably a little bit of each, right? I mean, like I think certainly in terms of Biden's, you know, background, right, as a senator originally, right? I mean, like he was, you know, he was somebody who was, you know, certainly widely perceived for a long time to be, you know, like, was there, you know, it's like the senator from the credit card companies.
Right, and, I think they used to say senator from MBNA was his. Right.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that's certainly a factor, but I mean, I think it's also just the sort of, I mean, I also don't necessarily think it's all like, oh, you know, I'm gonna get like a certain pile of campaign cash if I do X, Y, or Z or whatever. I mean, I think that there's a you know, sincerely held worldview that like emerges out of like having had those politics for all of that time and, you know, being aligned with those interests and, you know, being aligned with that part of the Democratic Party. I mean, I don't doubt for a second that all of these people have things that they can tell themselves about why everything that they do is like good and responsible. And, you know, and it's good that he's not creating moral hazard by forgiving millions and millions of people's, you know, student loans and all of this nonsense that, you know, that people always say. I mean, I'm sure that he believes that. And I mean, I think that probably the larger story there has to do with the ways that the Democratic Party as a whole has changed since like the 1970s, which is about like the decline and hence declining political power of organized labor, right? I mean, like that's a big thing, because I don't think you'd have the, you know, either the New Deal or the Great Society, you know, without that, and the party increasingly pivoting towards electorally towards like, you know, educated professionals, away from, you know, from their traditional base, you know, which has been, you know, very explicitly the strategy in a lot of recent elections. And even though Biden himself was kind of trying to reverse that with all the Joe from Scranton stuff, you know, I think that was like a pretty, like, I think that was pretty skin deep.
There's also a report out today showing that child poverty spiked by 41%. I think it went from a rate of, off the top of my head, 12% to 17%. Don't quote me exactly on that, but it amounted to a 41% increase in child poverty over the course of a month, essentially, mm-hmm. from December to January. It also just gives you a sense of like just how precarious things are in this country for people. And it was a function of the child tax credit that ran out. 250 a month for children 6 to 17, 300 per month for those under 6. And almost all the families in the United States. And it ended. And it goes from, yeah, the child poverty rate rose from 12% in December 2021 to 17% in January. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even Nancy Pelosi is always saying it's about the children. but how, like, how is this not, in what kind of society do we live that this is not, like, you know, even close to the outrage that is associated with, you know, the latest Durham filing or, I don't know, you know, the Canadian truckers or, you know,
Whoopi Goldberg
or Whoopi Goldberg or.
I mean, I'd really like a side by side comparison to the number of minutes of news coverage that were devoted to the child poverty strike, you know, spike and Whoopi Goldberg.
I mean,
I'd love that. Yeah.
I mean, honestly, it's like, I mean, I understand how the media works and understand that, like, but it's not like this is pouring out of, you know, everybody's Twitter feed either. It's available. You know, we do have areas where the bar to entry is pretty low, and, you know, the ice bucket challenge or whatever that was a couple of years ago that traveled on Twitter. Like, what, you know, what I just don't understand a society where you can't get really a peep out of almost anybody over like a 1 month spike in child poverty for such obvious reasons. It's because their parents are getting $250 or $300 less a month. I mean, that's it. This is a very simple, like, you know, here's my pen. I drop it. It falls. And that's it.
Yeah. I mean, I think that we're really trained in the kind of media environment we have now to just focus like 24/7 on like culture war and any kind of story that can be about like the morality of an individual person, right? You know, like is this you know, is this person who's in like the media like a good guy who we should all, you know, applaud, or like a bad person who, you know, whatever, you know, shouldn't be on The View, I guess, in that example, you know, that they have like a, that's the kind of thing that people are used to getting angry about and to thinking about. You know, I think that a lot of times stuff like child poverty, even though, as you point out, I mean, in this particular case, I mean, like the solution is like incredibly straightforward, and like there's this obvious causal relationship there. I think people are used to thinking of things like that as intractable, and so it's just like sort of pointlessly depressing to think about, right? Whereas, like, you know, whether somebody should get fired, or like what, you know, what comment somebody made at one time or another time or whatever, like I think seems more. Like that seems like more concrete. Like that seems like something that might really happen, that like somebody will get fired or won't get fired, or will apologize, you know, for something, or won't apologize for something. Whereas like, what are the conditions under which, you know, people in poor families are growing up? I mean, I think that's just kind of treated as like the background hum of how life is.
And it's also poverty. There's this apathy towards politics because there's like the we've been conditioned in this country that the government isn't really there to alleviate people's material conditions because poverty is a moral failing, and so there's a no literacy among the body politic to talk about poverty in political terms anymore. I think that's been largely erased from most of society.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it is really striking. Like if you think about like LBJ talking about a war on poverty, to think how unimaginable it would be to Biden would start talking about that like that, or that like the next president would start talking like that, you know, because people don't think of it as something that is tractable and maybe even as something that should be remedied, because it is so easy to I think the effectiveness of that kind of reactionary propaganda, that it's just a sort of individual, you know, moral issue, has been so overwhelming, right? I mean, the student loan example, right? That they, not that that's even, I think, the worst instance, or, you know, or should necessarily be at the very top of the priority list, you know, compared to something like child poverty. But the fact that so much discussion about the idea of student loan forgiveness ends up being a discussion of like, whether people made good choices leading up to having to take out student loans, and, you know, and whether they should have known better, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, rather than asking like, why do we have the kind of system where you have to take out loans to go to college in the first place, you know. But like, it's, again, if you could make it about individual morality, I think that that's something that a lot of people can much more easily understand and much more easily get excited about, because it's fun to judge people and it's not particularly fun to think about like the structural defects of how, you know, the economy works.
Why can't we even make fun of people and for people who are standing in the way of 41% of children not living in poverty?
You can't confront them in the bathroom.
I mean, if you know, I understand the limitations of U.S. society, at least in terms of like, you know, media and whatnot. And maybe that can be changed and maybe it can't. But it, you know, it is as it is right now. Why can't we make fun of, why can't the villain be the person, you know?
Why can't people be the villain for that? Right.
Yes. Look, we were talking Fatty Arbuckle 100 years ago. And, you know, I understand there's a certain amount of this that's involved in it. I mean, we engage in certainly mocking, you know, Steven Crowder or Ben Shapiro, whomever it is. You'd think, you know, somebody would have developed a machine to be able to also say like, oh, we could actually, how do we make the celebrity gossip in this instance about the fact that, you know, we've increased child poverty in the course of a month because of one simple, straightforward policy that Joe Manchin does not want in that bill, frankly. And also the other 50 Republicans.
What I immediately flashed to is like thinking back to last year when everybody spent a month arguing about the optics of AOC's dress that said tax the rich on it. And whatever you think about, like, you know, whether she should have done that or not. Like it is really striking, right? That like something like that gets so much more public attention than like, you know, I mean, just to be simplistic about this, just then the issue of whether we should actually tax rich people more.
I mean, it would be interesting if, you know, I don't know if there's another gala coming up, but that we increased 41% child poverty by 41% in 1 month because of the, I don't know if that's going to fit on a dress, but if it did, that'd be the one that I would wear. Ben Burgess, always a pleasure. Thank you so much. Folks can check out your book on Christopher Hitchens. At where can people get the book? Well, we'll put a link to it at majority.fm.
Yeah. So I mean, you can get it at all the usual book places, Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all of that stuff. If you do want to order it from a small worker-owned bookstore in Baltimore, you can order books from online. That's Red Emma's. If you just Google that and you'll find it. But thanks for having me on. And I'm just going to be thinking about the image of you wearing a dress that says child poverty was increased by 41%.
You wouldn't be the first one. Appreciate it, Ben. Right. Now we're going to take a quick break, right? We're going to take a break, right, Matt?
Yes.
Okay, we'll take a quick break. And we'll put a link to Ben's book at majority.fm via Red Emma's. And just a reminder, folks, Majority Live, if you want to come see us live in Brooklyn, you may not have through the weekend to buy your tickets. I think there's maybe a couple of dozen tickets left at this point. So if you want to come, we are on the verge of selling out. I told you it would happen quick. It's quick.
Very quick.
Brooklyn only seats, I think, like 350 or something like that. So you better hustle. Go to Majority Live. You can get your tickets there or to Boston. Quick break. Be right back with Jenna Friedman. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Joining us now, I'd like to welcome to the program Jenna Friedman. She is a comedian. She is a writer. Used to be a producer way back when, a field producer on The Daily Show when Jon Stewart was there. I know you wrote for Letterman. And you have a show, and you had a show, Soft Focus, that was on Adult Swim. And yeah. And now you have a new show, but you did it a little bit, right? Didn't it? Or did you do a pilot? Where
we have a first, well, season 1A, and now we're launching into season 1B.
and the show is indefensible. It mm-hmm. is a true crime show. I haven't seen it, but what will you please? How did you decide? Like, what in what way? Because I have some more familiarity with true crime shows than I probably should. My ex-wife was like a producer, director of those. And there's actually one where you can see my legs in one of those. Yes.
Wow. In like a reenactment. Cool. Mm-hmm. So AMC actually reached out to me. I did a set on Conan making fun of true crime. And they reached out wondering if I'd be interested in trying to develop a true crime show with them that had like a comedic feminist point of view. And I was a little wary, and then the pandemic happened. And
I'd be pretty wary if AMC called and said, oh, we want to do a feminist show about true crime.
Well, just, yeah. I mean, I just didn't know if like you could combine comedy and true crime. And then in the development process, we kind of landed on a way to add like levity to the genre. And it was by interviewing characters involved in the crimes who you kind of get to show their true colors or kind of fuck with them, which is one of the things that I like to do in my interviews. So then we ended up doing 6 episodes, and we go through a case, and then we kind of zoom out and look at the larger injustice and talk to people. And I talked to a lot of defense attorneys, which is hard to mine humor out of those interviews, because they're just like, it's like playing tennis against a wall. But yeah, I'll send you some episodes. You can check it out.
Well, go ahead, Emma.
No, I guess I just, a feminist take on true crime. Like, what did you see? That's what you said, right? I mean, because to me, I have a lot of friends that love true crime, right? And I can see the appeal, but sometimes I feel there's a portrayal of often female victims that's just, it's a little, it doesn't speak to me. I mean, what did you see in terms of like your spin on how you wanted to do this based on the wealth of like true crime podcasts and shows that you could see?
So a lot of it, the difference, there are a lot of things that I set out to do differently. We don't show gruesome crime scene photos. I don't interview the serial killers. In a couple episodes, I don't even name them. It's less about the actual case and more about the larger systemic injustice. And it's crazy that we've been, you know, consuming true crime, and there's so much of it for decades. And also so much of it is just not really told from that perspective. You know, like, it's not about the guy who kills the woman. It's about the parole system that allowed the guy to get out early and kill the woman because he had many, many charges of sexual assault, but because we don't take sexual violence against women seriously, these guys are really good at evading justice, serial offenders. But it's also, at the same time, I'm not like trying to be Nancy Grace or like pro mass incarceration. So it's like a measured approach. The best way I can describe it, if I could make it like the dream version of a show, I would say it would be like Daily Show meets Dateline, where it's like less about the crimes, but you're using crimes to bring in people who are like true crime junkies. And then you're just kind of zooming out and talking about like, why does this keep happening? What are things that we can do to stop it from happening?
I love that.
And part of it is too, it's like a business, I think is your argument, right?
Well, I mean, one of the jokes that I said in the Conan set that got their attention, I was like, true crime has become America's leading export in late stage capitalism. The joke being like all the manufacturing jobs are going overseas, but dead women are the one thing we still make in America. And then I'm like making a show. I'm part of the problem. So I'm just like trying to, and it also happened like during COVID. They approached me right before COVID and I was like, I don't know. And then like 6 months of shows got canceled and I was like, hey, I'm in. Like, but well, I think, very, yeah.
I appreciate the honesty.
I mean, but no, but the cool thing is I do think we kind of landed at a place where episode two, we get into this thing that I've been wanting to like tackle for a long time. I shouldn't say like violent words when I talk about violence, but it's our culture. But consent offenses, which if you're unfamiliar, they are like, I choked her during sex and she died accidentally. And they're also called the rough sex offense, and they've been outlawed in the UK, but they exist here and they don't normally get killers off. I know that's also a pun, but they do contribute to reduced sentences. And that's something that we talk about in episode two. There was this horrifying case that made the rounds in media because like the punchline or the headline was so salacious. It was like, man thought woman choked on his dick. And so he like stayed with her body for 3 days and like didn't call the ambulance and then got a defense attorney. And he is now free in Florida. And so when we approached this story, we talked to the victim's granddaughter. It was very hard to navigate because the punchline or sorry, because the headline seems like a punchline, but you know, we really made it like an indictment of the justice system that like when, like the reality is there probably was no sex act involved. It was just a creative defense in a state like Florida where you could convince a jury that this happened because people do doubt women, particularly when it involves like a sex act or sex crime.
And particularly, I would imagine women of color too. Like,
the victim's name was Francisca Martinez. Yes, women of color for sure. Like all women. I mean, these crimes are pretty common. There was the most known case was a guy in New York in the 80s, Robert Chambers.
I was just going to ask you about that. Yes. Because that was while I was in college. So I had contemporaries. I think I knew some guy who testified at that trial.
Wow. For which side?
Not the good side. I don't know. It was a guy named Chambers, I believe.
Robert Chambers was the killer.
And the preppy murder or something they called it. And he was supposedly, involved in sort of choking a woman in Central Park while they were having sex.
Jennifer, I'm blanking on her last name. Yes. So he's free now, but he did serve 15 years. But in our piece, we talked to a medical examiner who basically said there's really no way that you can choke someone to death accidentally. Like it takes a long time. And those are the kind of things that you get into. And just the idea that like in the UK, the rough sex defense has been outlawed because they as a society have decided like people do not consent to die during sex. It's just not a thing that happens. So stop using this as a defense of like an accidental death situation.
That's interesting. Also, I do remember with that case that
he said she started it. He said she wanted rough sex and
he said that she wanted. And then there was also some footage while he was out on bail where he was playing with a doll or something. I think early, maybe I'm making this up, so I probably shouldn't even say it, but
fan fiction, that
there was something that he did that really, you know, made it clear because this, when that happened, I mean, maybe I was just, you know, I was young, I was in college. I wasn't even aware of like, I had no, this, it was presented as some type of like exotic, New York City, culture, coming out of like Studio 84.
You know,
culture,
they're all sexual deviants.
Act. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, even today, I think I was talking to a comedian friend about it on her podcast and she's like, I like rough sex and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, yeah, sure. That really has nothing to do with this legal defense. Like, you can like rough sex and like being choked during sex, but that will not kill you. You know, it takes like 5 minutes of like it's not a sex act gone wrong when people die this way. And I think that that's like an important message because our culture, we are interested in like salacious sex acts and blah, blah, blah. But in this case, like the woman, there was no evidence that a sex act even happened, but because the defense was able to get creative because we live in a society that does doubt women, the defense worked.
This is not how I thought this interview was going to go.
I'm sorry. We can talk about Ukraine.
I wanted to bring up that I'm going to Disney, and they literally, I woke up 2 days ago, you know, and I got my kids prepared, and I'm like, we've got our N95 masks and our, you know, we got our mask for the flight, and we got our mask there, and I'm like, it's outdoors for most of the time. And I wake up, AP announces, Disney has announced they're going to drop their mask mandate tomorrow, as if something happened over the course of the 24 hours beforehand that completely changed it. And I have to say, I already had a certain amount of trepidation going to Disney. If the last pandemic was the Spanish flu, I would still be nervous about going to Disney. But we are actually just in or coming out of, maybe, knock on wood, a pandemic. So I'm that much worried. And they dropped the mask mandate without any warning. And it's not like I can call up and go, like, I want my money back. I mean, this seems that's what I wanted to. That's what I should have opened up with today.
Did you hear about the airlines wanting to put people on a no-fly list if they're, because the thing I'm interested in is all the disturbances on airplanes now. Just every single day, someone loses their shit on an airplane. And I think part of it is because, like, everybody's mentally ill right now. But a lot of it has to do with the mask mandates. And so the airlines were like, we need to have a no-fly list if somebody causes a disturbance on an airline. And these are really dangerous. Like, I think the other day somebody tried to open one of the doors, like, while in mid-flight. And I think it was...
That's not good. My understanding of not airplane good. Travel and physics is that's bad. That's bad, right? That's bad.
Yeah. But then, so there was like almost bipartisan consensus to put all these people on a no-fly list. And then I think this was like on the Daily. I'm just rehashing some podcasts I just listened to like while I was falling asleep. So I'm a really high source of information. But I thought that was really interesting in terms of, I think like 12 Republican senators stood up and were like, we don't want to put these people on a no-fly list because they, you know, you're infringing on their freedom. They're allowed to not wear masks on planes and cause disturbances, but it's like the double standard is so overt at this point, and it's so interesting.
I think you're right about that story. I think that might have been yesterday's news. We didn't talk about it much, but yeah, it was in our news packet. And it's just amazing to me that Republicans can, with a straight face, talk about certain airline restrictions being impinging on people's freedom when the entire Republican Party was, you know, I know this is a few years ago at this point, but I'm old enough to remember 9/11, and there were a lot of, like, they expanded the surveillance state and the Patriot Act and everything because of what happened on 9/11. I mean, they're totally fine with infringing on people's freedoms for terrorism purposes.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like maybe you should get two strikes and then two strikes and you get on it. Like, I mean, I think, you know, one time everybody has that moment. Maybe you get two strikes.
Airplanes,
it's hard to imagine, though. You wouldn't want, at least, you know, no, you know, like, they get an asterisk and a maybe. Uh-huh. Like, this is, I mean,
you don't get an upgrade.
Like, bodega, and they, you know, knocked over a display of food, I'd be like, I don't want you to come back in my store again.
Yeah.
Yeah, you should get two strikes if you get thrown out of TGI Fridays once. You should be able to come back and behave the next time.
That's right. I think that's true. You don't want to keep people out of that. Let's play this this clip. I want to just take your thoughts about what's happening with masks and just how authoritarian our country has become. I just heard this story from Charlie Kirk, who apparently he was at a TPUSA event in Phoenix, Arizona. Are you familiar with Charlie Kirk? Sadly,
If I were like Putin, I'd be like, no, I've never heard of him. You know, just phase them out. But yeah, unfortunately, I have.
Here's let's watch this clip of Charlie Kirk speaking at a TPUSA event. This is a horror show. I had no idea this was going on. Matt, can you pop this one up? Number 7.
And just a side note on this, you know, I was in California recently, all over. I come home for 24 hours. I try to go into a restaurant, and they say, "Show me your papers." I said, "What are you talking about? Show me your papers." Again, I live in Arizona. Somebody told me, "Show me what kind of papers you're talking about." Pretty naive, as like a phone. Like, what are you talking about? It's kind of weird. They said, "Where's your proof of vaccination?" I said, "What do you mean, like a measles, mumps, rubella vaccination, or like polio, or smallpox?" Like, I could get that. I think actually my pediatrician is not far from here that I grew up with. They're like, "No, the COVID vaccination proof."
It comes back.
His mic cut out?
Yeah. And so, not going to happen. So, and look, they were being nice enough. They were being very compliant Stasi members of the regime, right? They would have been, again, I never want to hear again, like, how could the atrocities of Germany happen? Like, go to Corner Bakery, all right? You'll see. Seriously. Show me your papers. Like, what? I don't want a panini. Like, this is weird. Show me your papers. And so it really kind of sunk in. And here I am coming back home, you know, being treated like I'm visiting East Germany. Literally, no exaggeration.
No exaggeration.
No exaggeration.
No shot they said, "Show me your papers."
I think the whole thing is a lie. But which comedian do you think is writing that material? That is a complete
that's
stand-up.
The thing, though. I think that's like the thing about all those grifters. They are like failed stand-up comics. It's like you can tell he wants to get laughs and he's trying to be funny, but he's also at the same time making his own point. He's like, measles, mumps, rubella. Exactly. We have vaccines that nobody questioned before you had like social media and like dark money funding dissent. I mean, I don't know. That kid is such a lightweight, such a little joke. And at least he acknowledges that the Holocaust exists. Yeah. I mean, if he's still in touch with his pediatrician, I don't even remember my pediatrician's name. He's like, "There's something on my dick, doctor."
There's no way that story is true at all. Nobody ever. Every place you go in New York that you go in and actually sit down and eat, I imagine it's the same in California. I mean, if you're just going in to order quickly, you don't.
People do ask to see your vaccine card if you're eating indoors.
If you're eating indoors, if you're just picking up a sandwich, I don't know. Like, you know, if I pick up a slice of pizza, they don't ask me. But if I'm sitting down.
But it's also on your phone. I don't even know why. I mean, we're in a pandemic. I don't know why that's such
an infringement. No one said, "Show me your papers," because nobody's carrying around their vaccine card. Everybody's pointing to their phone.
Maybe it was like a German restaurant worker who didn't really have a grasp of English. So he's like, "Show me your papers."
You know, the problem is he goes to Neo-Luddites for his panini, and there they don't use phones. So you actually do need to show documents. They won't. Mm-hmm. They don't recognize any screens there. Mm-hmm. That's part of the other problem.
Also, I have to show documents when I vote. Is that Nazis too?
Exactly. Well, show me your papers. You mean my ID? You mean like when I drive to register to vote? It is amazing that this is happening in this country. And, you know, we were talking to Burgess about it. There's a poll out there that Democrats have gone they've done too much. They've been too COVID-y during this, and it's supposedly going to hurt them. What is your sense, Jenna? I mean, is this country, are we done? Are we done?
It could have been over in 2000. You know what I mean? Like, we should have fought harder for Gore. I don't know. I think, democracies die. It's hard to see us turning back from this point. I try not to be doom and gloom. I think about this is so cheesy, but I've been doing comedy for 15 years, and the 15 years I've been in this one little pocket of our culture, I've seen so much positive social change. And I also think as like a woman, even though, you know, we could be slipping into fascism, there's been like no better time or place to be like a woman. I mean, Roe is like in the balance right now, so I could change my tune in like in June. But, you know, yeah, I think democracies are always a work in progress, and I don't know how we're going to get ourselves out of this one unless we have like a regulated internet and money out of politics and, you know, getting rid of propaganda valves like OAN and Fox. I don't, you know, I think people are going crazy and they're losing their minds, but on an individual basis, I think more people are cooler than they aren't, not to sound like Anne Frank, but
I mean, that's not bad to sound like that. I mean, that's an optimistic take. I think you're probably right in the end.
Well, talk more about that over the past 15 years, because it certainly within the context of comedy, there's been it seems to have changed dramatically. I mean, both in terms of how political comedians are in our culture. I mean,
do you think comedians are more political or less political?
Much more political than they were 15
years. Really? I think of like George Carlin, and I think of Greg Giraldo and Jon Stewart, and like I think almost there was like a lull for so long because it was like in like the, you know.
But Jon Stewart, I mean, he wasn't political for most of the Daily, you know, the Daily Show was like half just really, it seems to me, was, you know, started more about the media than it was, you know, being political per se. And that was about it. I mean, yes, Geraldo, but I mean, I'll tell you something. I went to the show you did at Union Hall, and when I was in comedy from the early 90s to the mid aughts or so, I went to, I don't know, 1,000 rooms like that, and there was more talk about political issues in that night than I saw in any given night ever before. Yeah. And it, I mean, partly because you do both, but even just like the other comedians too. And I know you that's somewhat self-selected, but people yeah, just did not 100%. Do Barry Crimmins and, was one of the few people who was doing political. And I was in San Francisco and I was in Boston. Yeah. I mean, these are not non-political places.
Yeah, well, definitely. I do think that there was like a lull of political comedy in the 90s. I mean, Janine was doing it, but I also think like right now it's kind of like the same thing where it's like if a glass of water drops, if you hear a glass shatter in a room, you have to acknowledge it. We're just in this moment where you can't ignore it. So even comedians, I've been doing political comedy for a while. I started out that way. But I think a lot of comedians are talking about it and we're exhausted. I'm trying not to talk about it, but again, it's the elephant in the room or that glass shattering. It's hard to escape it or to not acknowledge it. Especially when it's been so personal the past 2 years. We're literally all trapped in our homes because of a global pandemic and a botched response to it. And that had to do with politics. And I also 100% self-select the comedians that I put on the show.
Right. There was one joke that that you did the other night that I wanted to because I've contemplated the and it was about the, you know, because you mentioned in the context of you know, comedy, and there's been, you know, sort of at least some measure of accountability for you know, showbiz more than maybe other places in terms of like Me Too and within the context of comedy. But you talked about the sort of dynamic of being able to separate the artist from the art. Yeah, talk about that. I don't want to give away your joke, but
well, it's actually a bit that I still, it doesn't really land, and I might, it's just not, it's like I'm starting with it. That whole question of like how to separate the art from the artist, it's really interesting that's like what we're focusing on instead of like asteroid defense. Like we're all obsessed as a society as to like whether or not you can listen to Michael Jackson, or like, I'm still a fan of Annie Hall and I hate that I am. This is my favorite movie, but My take is very tepid. I don't have answers. But I do think that there is like an outsized attention to comedians and to culture in a way where like we ignore other things. Cause like we're all interested in, you know, celebrity and what have you. And so, I don't fully have that joke yet. I don't even remember what I said exactly that night.
Well, you said something to the effect. Can I remind
please.
You said something to the effect of like, it's so hard for me to separate the books from the accountant.
Okay. Yeah. How we're not looking. I mean, it's more like musicians. Oh, I probably forgot that part, but just the fact that like you can't even meet two musicians because we wouldn't even know where to start. You know what I mean? They all fucked teens back in the day. It was the '70s. And then how we're not looking as much at other, I said how do you separate the accountants from the books they keep? That's what it was. It's like, we're not thinking about that. We're just thinking really in art. That I think was like what I was trying to get at, but that's a hard bit because it feels more like a TED talk than it does jokes, and it's hard to open with.
But I'm glad TED talks are very popular.
Yeah.
Jenna Friedman, where can people get more information about your upcoming show?
I probably Twitter, or maybe Instagram. That's what I post on, and I'm doing more. I'm taping an hour in like possibly June. And so I'll be running it a bunch. I have like four shows at Union Hall in March, and I'm just going to be kind of testing out new jokes and working it out.
Where are you taping the show?
I don't know yet. It's for,
Can you say?
I don't know if I can say, but it's for one of the streamers, not Netflix.
One of the non-Netflix streamers.
Yeah.
All right. So we'll put a link to your Instagram and to your Twitter feed at majority.fm. Thanks so much for coming on, Jenna.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Bye, guys.
All right, folks. Yeah, we got time for a short fun half. We're going to take a quick break. Head into the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can be a part of the fun half by becoming a member. Join themajorityreport.com. You may have, yeah, if you're listening to the free show, you probably notice a little bit that we're having a little bit of not quite ad apocalypse, but looking into it and finding out there's been some changes in the podcast advertising methodology that does not behoove us. And so we're working on that. But in the meantime, it means that we're relying ever more so on our listeners for their support. So if you listen to the free show and you enjoy it and you have the finances, it's not going to be a stretch or a strain on you. And you can support the show, join themajorityreport.com, become a member today. Also, don't forget, we got a merch shop, shop.majorityreportradio.com. And we have an email blast every day called the AM Quickie. You can sign up for that. It is free. amquickie.com. Don't forget those live shows. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian Media universe? Oh, we got to set up your camera.
Yeah, we do at some point.
Well, that's phase two. I don't know if people noticed. We're not going to talk specifically quite about it yet, but I'm sure people have noticed there's been a slight upgrade in the quality of our video. Also on the back end, we'll be talking more about that in the coming weeks. I am going on vacation, as I mentioned, to Disney with my kids. So I may never be back, but chances are I will.
You're just going to fall in love with Orlando to such a degree that I don't know. I could just see you purchasing property in the Disney Village. That's the vibe I get from you. But
it could be an option.
Sam's Golden Girls years.
Yeah,
that's right. I don't know how my kids will get back. My kids will have to come back, but. They'll go to school in Disney.
Oh.
Matt, what's happening in Matt Lekian Media Universe?
Last Wednesday we had Jason and Pascal from This Is Revolution on. We had a really fun conversation. This weekend, David and I are going back to our Karl Marx reading series for Karl Marx's early essay on the Jewish question, which is controversial two-part essay. We're going to get into Marx's history. His father converted to Christianity because of anti-Semitism. Both his grandfathers were rabbis. And Marx had some anti-Semitic attitudes, but this essay, actually part one, is a brilliant defense. It says Jews should be allowed to have political rights even if they don't renounce their faith, which is a way ahead of its time defense of political rights there. And then part two, we're going to get into where he sort of yes-ends some anti-Semitic things about Jews and their love for money in a very problematic way, but he's trying to make a point that like Christianity is as money grubbing as what they say about Jewish people. So we're going to get into that. We have a text kind of explaining Marx's interesting relationship with Judaism. So patreon.com/leftreckoning.
All right, folks, 646. Well, I don't know if we're going to have time for phone calls today, actually, but we will take your IMs. You can IM the show via the app at majority.fm or majorityapp.com. Oh, maybe we'll take a couple of calls. We got a couple of people who are on the phones. We'll take a couple of calls. How's that? All right. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, 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 boy is back, and the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
And the alpha males are back, 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 boy is back, and the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. Okay. I'm making stupid money.
A hell of a lot of bang.
A hell of a lot of bang.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on!
To pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.